Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa. Gregory Joseph, Program Director at National Coalition Against the Death Penalty, joins host Craig LeBeau to discuss trends in the death penalty. This will include new moratoriums, Trump's attempt to resume the death penalty at the federal level, and exonerations, as well as bipartisan attempts to repeal the death penalty in some states. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn.
Okay, thank you for joining us here on Jaws of Justice. This is Craig LeBeau, and today we are going to be talking about the death penalty. And my guest is Gregory Joseph. He is a program director at the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty. And the National Coalition includes various state chapters. And we're going to be talking about recent developments since the last time I had Gregory on, which was, I think, maybe about a year ago. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you for having me, Craig.
Okay. Let me start with have you go through, on your website, there's a list of five, basically, reasons that we want to get rid of the death penalty. What are those reasons for that your organization wants to do that?
Always thank you again for having me. A pleasure to come and talk to you about this important topic. You know, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty does have a few reasons that they oppose the death penalty, mainly from a, you know, ranking them in order, so to speak. You know, obviously, we feel that it's a cruel and unusual punishment. We feel that there's a large degree of racial bias that comes into death sentences. We believe that the impact on the victims' families is something that needs to be addressed, and we're not taking that into account. There's also a large degree of innocence that we see with people on death row. And we find that death penalty itself is doled out in an arbitrary fashion that is unfair for everyone. So those are just some of the kind of top-level reasons why we oppose the death penalty, and we've seen public opinion kind of shifting in favor of abolition.
All right. Let me go through with you recent developments, and then I'm going to want to come back to that list and ask you some more specific questions on that. The federal death penalty, President Obama, I believe, was the one who initiated the moratorium. And what has happened with that? I saw there was a new development just this past week. So can you fill us in on the federal?
Sure. Well, earlier this year, the President of the United States instructed the Attorney General to restart the federal death penalty. And there were six individuals that received execution dates. I believe the first one was actually scheduled for December 9th, so just a few weeks away, for that matter. But last week, a circuit court, a federal court, excuse me, in Washington, D.C., had postponed temporarily stayed the execution that was set on a federal level. And so we currently don't have any federal execution scheduled. The court's reasoning was that the federal executions had to be done in a manner that is consistent with the state executions in Indiana. And so there was a drug protocol issue. But Indiana has a three-drug protocol, and the federal government was going to move forward different executions that were using just one drug. And so the court ruled that to be not just. And so those executions are now stayed. And we'll see exactly what the next steps from the federal government will be on those cases.
All right. And when the court issued an injunction against them proceeding with those executions, what is the next step then?
Well, we'll see. I haven't been in touch with the legal teams representing these individuals on death row, so I don't know what the next steps will be. But we will obviously be, paying close attention to what next legal steps are going to take. But this is just happened last week, so there hasn't been any move from the federal government or from the defendants for anything extra as of yet.
All right. Let's look at some of the states. Well, first of all, can you tell us on the federal level how many people are on death row?
How many people are on the federal death row?
Right.
I don't know. I'm unaware of actually how many people are on the federal death row.
All right. At the state level, most recent that I'm aware of, maybe there's some others, to issue a moratorium is California. Is that correct?
Correct. Well, California issued a moratorium. New Hampshire abolished the death penalty legislatively earlier this year. Washington State, about a year ago, the state Supreme Court ruled the death penalty unconstitutional on the grounds of racial bias. And then obviously California, the governor issued a moratorium on all the active death sentences. So there's been a legislative victory in the last year, a court victory in the last calendar year, and a governor commuting the sentences. So it's been a really strong year for death penalty legislation and cases.
All right. And when you say commuting the sentences, is that actually what California did?
I apologize. I apologize. You do not commute the sentences. You place a moratorium on the death penalty, and all of those death sentences are currently stayed.
All right.
And then the state of California and the activists in California are debating some legislative changes to the death penalty that would hopefully result in abolishment.
All right. And one of the states, I don't recall if it was Washington, I'm thinking, they abolished the death penalty. But then I saw on your website, they still have inmates on death row. Can you give us an idea as to why that would be?
They still have inmates on death row because they haven't commuted those sentences to something else. They will be on death row until their cases are relitigated, so to speak.
All right.
But given the fact that the racial bias was the number one reason why the death penalty was abolished in Washington, leads you to believe that some of these cases may need to be retried because these people might have received a death sentence solely based on the color of their skin. And so therefore, there could be an actual different sentence handed down. It'll be interesting to see exactly what happens to some of those cases, and some of those people might actually have large degrees of innocence.
Okay. Let's address a little bit more on that racial bias part. But before we do that, I do want to give out, for those who might have a question or a comment, want to call in, the number here is 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. And we do welcome your questions or comments. So on the racial bias, how does that play into that then? And how, from what you've seen, your perspective, how would you go about establishing that somebody was convicted because of the race?
You mean how would you make that legal argument?
Right. Well, not necessarily just a legal argument, but as a practical matter, how do you convince an appeals court, for instance, that there was race as a basis of the conviction?
Well, I think there's a few ways. I mean, I know there's one case where there's an individual who has been striking African Americans from the jury and literally getting all white juries to sentence black defendants to death. And so that's a claim for racial bias that has been made against a few prosecutors in this country. That's where some of the bias is exposed during this jury selection. And district attorneys and prosecutors actively seeking juries with no people of color. And so that's one of the claims that we've seen that raise towards racial bias.
Okay. One of the things that came up in one of the cases that I had in Kansas, I was trying to establish that in what's called the 1507 action. And the case that was overturned because of that, in that other case, I think it was from Georgia, was that the prosecutor had in his notes indication or remarks that showed an obvious scheme, if you will, to exclude people of color on the jury. And the defense had somehow been able to discover their notes. I don't know what the process was. They don't have that kind of process in Kansas. But in Kansas, I was not able to prevail because there was nothing, at least nothing that I'm aware of, that we were able to discover to show in writing that that's what the prosecutor was doing. Whereas in Georgia, they had something written. So it's a practical matter. It seems like it's a really extremely high hurdle to establish racial bias, even when it's obvious. Are there other areas of the justice system or the process that contribute to racial bias besides jury selection?
Well, I think, you know, some police departments and prosecuting offices need to reexamine their entire criminal justice procedures because, you know, we see that there's racial bias and a lot of, you know, in a lot of areas in the criminal justice system. So, you know, even though there might not be sort of like a quote-unquote paper trail, you do have to look at the conviction rates of people of color and see how many of them are sentenced to death over people or non-people of color. You can really start to re-kind of examine, you know, the entire criminal justice system and kind of look to see where the biases exist. It's pretty hard, you know, to see that there's no racial bias in any of the criminal justice systems across this country. And so I think it's really kind of a time to kind of police the police, so to speak.
All right. We have in a a lot of jurisdictions now, they're popping up these units they call conviction integrity units. Tell us a little bit what that's about and if you've seen progress at exonerating innocent people as a result of that.
I think those examinations have led to some good revelations in terms of weeding out some of the corruption that happens with regards to the criminal justice system. We've seen exonerations happen across the country for a litany of reasons. So it's always good to see people kind of looking back and making sure that the convictions are proper and just. And I think, you know, every time you look into a case, you'll find these, you know, inconsistencies that lead people to question whether or not the sentence was just. So I think that, you know, when people are kind of going back and reexamining these cases, it's always good. And I think we see a lot of people raising legal issues because there are these cases now being kind of reexamined.
All right. At the opposite end of that is a show that I saw back in the 90s. I know it was in the 90s because it was a little bit before I purchased my house. It was on PBS. I don't recall what show it was, but on PBS, and they would talk about the death penalty, and they featured a prosecutor from Texas. I don't remember what area of Texas, but he said he was arguing that death penalty is a effective deterrent and lowers crime and lowers homicide, et cetera, which I think most people disagree with, experts, when they look at the statistics. But he was arguing that the death penalty, that even though you might make an occasional mistake, his argument was you save far more lives by having the death penalty, even at the risk of executing an innocent person. So tell me what your thoughts are on that. What's wrong with that, and what's wrong with the deterrence theory?
Well, you know, we don't see any evidence that the death penalty deters crime. I think that has largely been a myth that has been spread by legislators and prosecutors, but there's really no evidence to that. We've had, for many of years now, states with an active death penalty have higher rates of homicide than states with non-death penalty. So we see that that talking point is being deterrent, no longer just something that's not valid. And it's not anything that prosecutors link back to as what we would say effective public policy. The death penalty is not deterred by.
All right. But some would argue that even though it's not maybe what we know of as a general deterrence, it at least prevents that particular person from going out and committing more crimes. What would your response be to that?
There's effective ways to punish people that would prevent them from committing more crimes that do include death penalty. So if you're trying to prevent someone from ever committing a crime again, you could put them in prison. The death penalty seems to be kind of a very cruel and unusual way to prevent someone from committing another crime again. And there are a lot of criminal justice programs that we can spend money on that aren't the death penalty that would reduce crime and make neighborhoods safer. So we're spending resources on an ineffective policy that does not prevent crime, where we could be spending our resources on actually proven public policy programs that actually do prevent crime. And these are not just necessarily criminal justice programs, but, you know, you want to prevent crime from being committed, you know, you need to invest in education, and you need to create economic opportunities for entire communities and lift up support systems in the mental health area and healthcare and community supports as well. So, you know, if you're going to spend money on the death penalty, it's not going to make crime, it's not going to lower any crime. You can spend resources on effective, proven criminal justice strategies that will help reduce crime.
All right. And do you have any figures or trends as far as what the cost is of implementing the death penalty versus a case that would be maybe life in prison without parole?
Well, the death penalty is more expensive than life without parole. So, from a cost perspective, you know, the death penalty costs jurisdictions more money to adjudicate and carry out than an actual life without parole sentence.
All right. Gregory, we're getting, I'm not sure where you're standing at, but we're getting a lot of background noise right now.
Sorry. I'm trying
to.
I gave it a little quiet, of course.
Okay. So, in terms of the cost and stuff, and lost my train of thought there, sorry. Let's move on. The other thing you indicated was the issue of innocence. And before we get to that, I'm going to want to talk to you about the number of people who have been exonerated and stuff, but we do need to take a break. If you'll stay on, and we'll be back in about 1 to 2 minutes with Gregory Joseph after these PSAs. And we are taking phone calls, so when we come back on, again, the number is 816-931-5534.
Every Tuesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m., Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced public affairs program, spotlights individuals and organizations in our community that deal with ideas and issues of social and political significance, such as climate change, racial and gender inequality, pay inequity, and much, much more. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesdays, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Did you know your business or organization could be sponsoring this episode of Jaws of Justice Radio? Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
Now the calendar for the week of November 25th. Corey's Network will have their weekly meeting with a survivors workshop, beginning the Journey 1, on Monday, November 25th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, the City House, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Independence, Missouri. The church is east of the Hy-Vee on 40 Highway. Corey's Network asks us to please join their weekly meetings to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop, not a grief group. Please include only those individuals mature enough in age to deal with issues being covered during the meeting. Check their website, coreysnetwork.org, or phone 816-866-7868. This is the week of Thanksgiving. Here's a list of community Thanksgiving dinner events. Tuesday, November 26th, 5 to 8 p.m., Casey Parks, Reach One, Teach One, New Zion Missionary Baptist Church, and Beauty of Holiness Church present the first annual
Marlboro Community Centered Thanksgiving Dinner at Marlboro Community Center, 8200 Paseo Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri. Operation Thanksgiving is giving bags of food to prepare for Thanksgiving on Tuesday, 11/26, from 8:30 a.m. until noon. This will be at Della Lamb Community Services Mabee Center Gym, 406 Woodland Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Call 816-842-8040. On Wednesday, November 27th, will be the 13th Annual Voices of the People Community Thanksgiving Dinner, 4 p.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Cleveland 2nd Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri. For more information, contact brandon.ellington at kcmo.org. The Salvation Army is offering a Thanksgiving meal to the community on Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, November 28th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 101 West Linwood, Kansas City, Missouri. Link is having a traditional Thanksgiving meal for the community on Thursday, November 28th, from 12:30 to 3:30 p.m. at the Lawrence Interdenominational Nutrition Kitchen site, which is in the basement of the First Christian Church at 221 West 10th Street, Lawrence, Kansas. There'll be an opportunity to leaflet the public about boycotting war toys on Friday, November 29th from 5 to 6 p.m. at the corner of 9th and Massachusetts, Lawrence, Kansas. This is the kickoff of the annual Don't Buy War Toys campaign by the Lawrence Coalition for Peace and Justice. On Saturday, November 30, there will be the Wyandotte County Monthly Membership Meeting for Moms Demand Action, Kansas. This will be 11 a.m. at the Kansas City, Kansas Main Public Library, 625 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. This month, the discussion will be the words we use in our gun violence prevention efforts. All are welcome, mothers and others. Go to act.everytown.org for more information. My name is Teresa Wilkie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn.
Okay, this is Craig Lubo, and thank you for staying with us here on Jaws of Justice. For those of you just joining us, my guest is Gregory Joseph. He is the program director at the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty. Welcome back, Greg.
Thank you for having me again.
So I said before the break, I wanted to address the innocence issue. Tell us what's been happening with that and the number of exonerations, as far as you know. And do we have any evidence that any innocent people have, in fact, been executed?
Do we have any evidence? I think we have statistical evidence that shows that there's a high probability that someone innocent has been executed. There has been no kind of, you know, evidence that it's actually happened. But I think if you just look from the from a statistical standpoint, you definitely see that there has been people who were people with large degrees of innocence who might have been executed, unfortunately. There's always cases. Just last week, Rodney Reed was facing an execution date, he has always maintained his innocence, and I believe a court has now stayed his execution, and there's a possibility that there's some DNA that was not included and tested in his original trial that could lead to him being exonerated. That might actually be taken up in court. Rodney has always maintained his innocence. And I think, if this DNA is able to be tested, it will go a long way to proving that he was actually wrongfully convicted.
And Rodney is a guy from Texas, is that correct?
From Texas.
Okay.
Yes, from Texas.
And
yes.
All right. And I wanted to go back to, there was one other thing that I thought of, race discrimination. And I had attended a federal CLE. Oh, this was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. For those who want to know what CLE is, it's continuing legal education seminars for lawyers. And there was an expert who had done studies on race discrimination, and they looked at, they did research on how the jurors, this was after jury selection, during the trial and the fine and the guilt phase, how they looked at people of color and the results. And they not only looked at what Caucasians, how they voted and stuff, but they also looked at people of color. It was interesting that research showed that light-complected people of color were more likely to vote guilty against somebody with a dark complexion as opposed to somebody with a light complexion. So my question is, with findings like that, how do you fight a result like that? How do you overcome that kind of bias?
You know, I think there's, you know, there are lots of trainings and seminars and resources that people are now putting themselves into to kind of, you know, understand racial bias, to understand, you know, white privilege, so to speak. You know, it's education, it's exposure, it's understanding. These are things that will help, you know, end racial bias. Unfortunately, it's not like there's not a pill you can take or a box you can check, but it's really a reflection that each individual has to really start to do on their own to see if there's any sort of bias in the way that they operate and live their lives. And once that bias is kind of, you know, rooted out, we'll start to see more genuine everything in terms of sentences and the way that we treat people and policies. But, you know, it's really kind of an individual reflection and education that has to kind of become before we can start to see kind of racial bias kind of going out and not being a part of our criminal justice system.
All right. And I do want to give out our phone number again. We are taking calls for listeners who might have a question or a comment. The number is 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. I know some of you must have questions on a topic like this, so please call. Don't be shy. Okay, on the exonerations, how do you have statistics on how many people have been exonerated?
I believe there are 215 people who have been exonerated. But let me quickly check that. But I believe the last time we had 250 wrongful conviction exonerations.
Okay. And that includes not just people on death row, but all inmates, is that correct?
That is included all, not just death row, correct.
Okay. On your website, it has a list of people who have been wrongfully executed. How, on what basis do we know that those were, in fact, people who were wrongfully executed. Were they exonerated after their executions or some other way?
I'm sorry, could you, I lost you there just for a quick bit. Could you repeat that, Craig? I'm sorry.
Sure. Okay, so on your website, there's a list of some people who were wrongfully executed, and the question is, do they have DNA evidence in those cases that came after the executions, or was there some other way that they determined that they were in fact wrongfully executed?
I think there's a few cases. There's a combination of the factors. One was new emerging evidence, DNA evidence, and some not DNA evidence, but new emerging evidence that casted large degrees of doubt on their conviction and obviously on their sentence being carried out. So sometimes it is, sometimes it is DNA, sometimes it's a part of the case that no longer holds up. Sometimes, like for instance, it's eyewitness testimony that the person has recanted recanted what they saw, and it's pulled into consideration the actual case. And then sometimes it's DNA that has been revealed to show that the person or person didn't commit the crime and somebody else did. But it's unfortunate, and that's one of the problems with the death penalty is that, mistakes, you can't go back and correct the mistake and find that there's evidence that emerges post execution is a really sad point in our criminal justice system, when we see that after someone has been executed and evidence has been come to light that proves that person was innocent. And it's a shame that that occurs, and it's again another reason why the death penalty is totally cruel and unusual. This person was not given due justice.
In the repeal efforts that have been going on in various states, this is an issue that seems to be bipartisan. You've got people from both parties seeking repeal, and you've got people from both parties opposed to repeal. And when I say both parties, I'm talking about the two major parties, the Republicans and Democrats. Of course, there's other parties too, but how is the coalition dealing with that? How have they been able to reach people on both sides of the aisle and make it a bipartisan issue?
Well, the facts. The facts are always what, brings people to death penalty reform. And the facts are bipartisan in nature because they talk about a large degree of policy issues that the death penalty impacts. So when they talk about, the cost and the deterrent to crime, that it's not. These are all policy areas that there's wide support. No one is going to, people are not, people are not trying to hold up this unfair system. And I think that both Democrats and Republicans and everybody else in between are seeing that the death penalty is flawed, that the death penalty is broken. You see 215 people who've been exonerated from death row, that shows you that the system is broken. And I think that it is one of these great moments where we're seeing people from both sides of the aisle come together and address criminal justice system and the death penalty. And it'd be great if we could find this kind of bipartisan spirit in a lot of policy areas. But it's good that, Democrats and Republicans, tough on crime people and pro-life people and people who are for wise and smart government and people who are looking for the impact on victims are all coming together and repealing and reforming the death penalty. It's great that people are, and it's not coming down on political sides.
Okay. In Nebraska, and I believe this was somewhere around about four years ago, there was a Republican legislator who was on our show at one time who took the lead at getting the legislature up there to abolish the death penalty, and they voted it out. I don't recall exactly who the governor was at that time, but at some point, I don't know if it was the same governor or the subsequent one, made it an issue, got it on the ballot, spent millions of dollars of supposedly of his own money to bring back the death penalty. And then the public, that the effort to bring it back succeeded in the vote. So how do you confront that in the sense that it might tend to discourage legislators or inhibit them from seeking repeal because of what happened in Nebraska? Has that slowed down the repeal effort in other states because of that?
No. It hasn't. I think it's one of the unique things about this issue is that it's very independent of what happens in each state. And each state has its own legislative path or judicial path, and it's really what happens in another state is not something that really carries over from another one. Nebraska was unfortunate, but, you know, right next door in Colorado, well, not right next door, but right next door in Colorado, there was a governor who was elected who ran on an issue of opposing the death penalty. Every state is unique in its journey towards abolishing. And what happens in one state doesn't really affect what's happening in another state.
All right. I want to bring it a little bit closer to Kansas and Missouri for a couple minutes here. Missouri, of course, still has the death penalty. And I see from your site, they have executed 87 people since 1976. And for listeners who aren't aware of the sequence of what has gone on, at one point the Supreme Court had ruled the death penalty unconstitutional. And so it was halted for a few years, but they left room for it to be brought back. And so at some point after the problems were allegedly taken care of, which I think there's some doubt about that, but at some point the Supreme Court allowed it to come back, and that was in 1976. So frequently when we talk about the death penalty, we talk about execution since it was reinstated in 1976. So in Missouri, what is being done and what kind of progress do you think can be made in Missouri to get rid of the death penalty?
I know that there has been some progress in terms of the death penalty, in terms of it's being now communicated in a lot of different circles that, you know, for people to really start thinking about repeal and abolishment. I know a good friend of ours, Rick Stack and Maggie Stogner, who are two professors at American University in Washington, D.C., and the co-directors of a very powerful movie called In the Execution of Shadow. And they recently just held a screening of that movie in St. Louis back in August, and have been working really closely with our affiliate, Missourians Against the Death Penalty, on organizing more screenings of this film. And this film is really powerful to show people exactly all of the flaws within the death penalty. And so the fact that there are people coming out to see this movie, and it's forming their opinion for abolition, could mean that there could be a renewed passion to move an abolition bill, or to really just restart the dialogue on showing exactly what are the flaws in the death penalty. So really excited to see more people come to this film, and some of the active community engagement that's happening in Missouri. I think once the community starts to be engaged and people start to talk about the death penalty, is when you'll start seeing a more of a legislative push.
All right.
People are talking, which is great.
In Kansas, it's pretty much the opposite situation. They do still have death penalty, but it's more narrowly applied. Missouri, it can be used in any first-degree murder case, whereas in Kansas, there's a list of 8 aggravating circumstances that have to exist, and there are 10 people on death row, but there has not been an execution in Kansas since 1965, I believe. Why do you think there's a difference there? Why are juries handing down death penalty less frequently in Kansas, and why are we not executing people like they are in Missouri?
Well, that's a good thing that you're not executing people like Missouri. You know, I don't know. I would assume that the reason that there aren't death sentences being handed down is that prosecutors and juries are understanding that people can be punished without taking their lives, and I think that's a positive, and they're showing that. That the death penalty does not necessarily have to deter crime. And I think that's another part of the reason why people aren't handing down death sentences, because they're saying that it doesn't deter crime because they're having all of these people pop up in homicide cases. But the fact that juries are not returning death sentences or prosecutors aren't asking for the death penalty leads me to believe that there are people who believe that punishment does not necessarily have to include a death sentence to be severe and keep public safe. So the lack of death sentences coming out of Kansas is very encouraging, and it would be nice if other states nearby would follow suit. But we're happy that there are not any death sentences being handed out in Kansas the way that they are in Missouri and other states.
And the fact that more and more states have adopted as an alternative life without parole, meaning that absent an exoneration, they're not going to get out. Is that something that is helping to move the public toward being opposed to or favoring repeal of the death penalty?
Yeah, I do think that when people understand that, you know, abolishing the death penalty doesn't mean that everyone just walks out of prison and goes back to, you know, where they live, that I think that people also need to realize that people who support abolishing the death penalty are not people who don't, who are weak or soft on crime, so to speak. I think that when people are seeing that there are sentences that can keep people who are dangerous and who harm society away from the public, but you don't have to go out there and execute them. I think that people are seeing that these are reasonable alternatives to the death penalty. And it's nice, you know, it's nice that people are understanding that, you know, that the death sentence is not something that needs to happen in order for them to feel safe from society.
All right, we just have about a minute and a half left. I want to ask you real quick. What I know, part of the opposition is the impact on victims' families. So what are you finding when you talk to victims' families, how the majority of them feel?
Well, I don't want to speak for the majority, but... Well, first of all, I mean, one thing that needs to be said in terms of victims is that people need to hear the side of victims, and really they need to be taken in consideration when we think about the totality of the death penalty. You know, that's one of the great things about that movie, In the Execution of Shadow. There is a large interview with a woman by the name of Vicky Schreiber. Vicky's daughter was murdered in Philadelphia back in the 1990s. And Vicky is very adamantly opposed to the death penalty. So when the perpetrator was caught, she made it a point to talk to the prosecutor and make sure the prosecutor understood that the family did not want the death penalty pursued. The prosecutor did not listen to them. But
Greg, we are out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. In reference to that movie, the producer of that was Rick Stack, I know, and we'll be having him on Jaws of Justice on some future date. So be watching for that. And so for those who joined us recently, we've been talking to Gregory Joseph from the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty. And next up is 420 Drug News. Thank you, Greg.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
I'm Colleen Cowles. I am a mother. I'm an attorney. And the two roles have met in writing a book called War on Us, How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on All of Us.
All right. Now, that, I don't know. I think more and more people around the country, around the world, are beginning to see that perspective that you're presenting. But tell us what brought you to write that book.
Largely frustration with the system and understanding that as an attorney, I thought I had an idea of what was happening with the war on drugs, the purposes, the impact. When we ended up dealing with it on an individual basis, it was eye-opening, and it made me realize that even people that are within the system, whether it's physicians, law enforcement, defense attorneys, parents, across the board, everyone sees their small piece of it. But there's no way until you're engulfed in it personally to understand the cascade effects that this war is creating. Once I started looking at that and started understanding that it's not just a small segment of people that are impacted, but it's everyone. Everything from civil liberties to health to parents being having retirement funds wiped out, trying to keep their children, not only finding treatment and health care for them, but paying fines and fees so that they're not thrown in jail and having their lives destroyed because they were picked up with a pill in their pocket or a joint.
And the ramifications, the continual oversight, the need for those fines and fees and urine tests and judges' visits and on down the line, that in many cases just stifle people's ability to hold down a job to meet that requirement, which is often part of their sentence, so to speak.
Absolutely. One thing that we know about addiction now is that it is created and exacerbated by trauma and isolation. So what have we done over the last 50 years in our war on drugs is created isolation and trauma. And then we wonder why we've escalated the addiction epidemic. We now have medications that will cut the risk of overdose, according to all of our government agencies, cut the risk of overdose in half. We have medications that will allow people who've struggled with addiction for long term, who are now being properly treated and ending up being able to hold jobs, go back to normal life.
I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.